Why don't we go around and have every site introduce themselves? So this is the University of Arizona. I'm Anthony Muscat. We have Dr. Shadman and several graduate students here from the groups.
Hi, this is Raghav from Stanford University Material Science Department. I'm working for Paul McIntyre Group.
Hey, this is Steve Bowden at ASU. I'm not sure if any of my students are on also. From the silence, I say they're not, so just me and him.
This is Rich Abraham, SpeedFam High Tech in Chandler, Arizona.
Kip Quantum, SpeedFam High Tech, Chandler, Arizona.
Greg Herman, Practice
Test. KSI, AMD, Austin.
Gautam Banerjee, Ashland, Dublin, Ohio.
This is Gary Lidloff at the University of Maryland with several students, Sun Cho, Wei Li, Dihao Tsai, and so on.
This is Jerry Silverman at IBM.
Ken McCall at IBM.
John DeGentle at TI.
Okay, so let me introduce Alan Bowling, the speaker today. First off, Alan, thanks very much for agreeing to give a talk to us. Alan is currently a TI Fellow and Manager of External Research for Texas Instruments Silicon Technology Development Group. And he also manages a small group of people who coordinate this group's involvement in external research, so including Semitech, the SRC, the MARCO program, IMAC, LETI, and other university research programs. So Alan has a PhD in chemistry, and he joined TI in 1980 as a process control engineer at the MOS 2 wafer fab. And he has a lot of he's been involved in a lot of different programs. I'd just like to pick out one that I'm familiar with, and that was the MMST program on single wafer processing for flexible manufacturing that the U.S. Air Force supported. And I think Alan will talk about this particular program in his talk today. And that was done, I think, in the late 80s. Wasn't that true, Alan?
Right.
Okay. So it was very much ahead of its time. And then Alan became, in 2002, so relatively recently, he was elected as a member of the fellows at TI. And this is a select group of people. There are only 62 fellows at TI. So again, Alan, thanks very much for agreeing to give the talk. He gave this talk at the UCPSS program, Ultra Clean Processing for Silicon Surfaces, in Ostend, Belgium, about 2 weeks ago. And I think you'll see a lot of the themes and things he'll talk about resonate with the different projects in our center. So let me just remind the speakers before Alan starts to please, not the speakers, but the participants, before Alan starts, please put your telephone on mute so all the background noise is reduced. So Alan, thanks very much, and I'll let you begin.
Okay. Thanks for the invitation. As Anthony noted, this is a talk I gave a few weeks ago at the Ultra Clean Processing for Silicon Surfaces meeting. It's intended to be an overview talk. It was the keynote talk at that conference, and so I don't have a tremendous amount of details about specific things in it, but it's more of some discussions of future challenges. So the title of my talk, I'll direct you to slide one, is Future Challenges for Cleaning and Advanced Microelectronics. And I have some co-authors who actually helped with some of the data that's specifically here. They're Brian Kirkpatrick, Trace Hurd, Laura Losey, and Phil Mast. And going to slide two.
wafer cleaning, for many years we just call it wafer cleaning, and I think the perception was that at least when I started in the industry in, the, in 1980 that we were all doing everything we could to eliminate wafer cleans because they were kind of considered as non-value-added process steps. And I think the more we worked on that, we recognized that some were very important, and we actually added the word surface preparation to that to recognize the importance of some of the cleaning steps, especially for things like pre-gate clean. And later on, post-CMP clean and things like that have become more important as well. So slide number three, I wanted to note that we simply can't achieve high yields without the use of wafer cleaning. I don't believe that production-worthy CMP could exist without having post-CMP cleans. Our gate oxides wouldn't work without pre-gate cleans. And for almost all the etch steps, we have to follow them with some sort of post-etch clean, resist residue removal to enable high yields. In slide number four, I wanted to talk a little bit about past predictions. In the early 1990s, several authors, including myself, we all predicted, or a number of people predicted, that there might be a chance that we could all go to an all-gas phase wafer cleaning. We had ideas that there might be ways to actually cluster steps, speed up the overall flow of wafers through the fab by clustering, or I think there are some positive things about clustering and also positive aspects of single wafer approaches that have shown a lot of promise, and a lot of our processing has gone to single wafer, but one of the things that hasn't happened is we've not been able to make all gas phase cleans work. And if you examine why that's true, I've speculated here that I think some of the reasons are that they seem to work well for specific homogeneous material removal, but don't work well for the removal of particle excursions or process residues that tend to be inhomogeneous. And consequently, we found we have to combine steps. And the next slide, number five, shows that some examples. The one on the left is post-via etch for copper dual damascene. And in that case, we actually followed the via etch by an ash and then an attempted plasma dry clean. But we got lots of these things we call stringers, which then blocked the future trench etch and created these defects on the wafers. And we couldn't get rid of that until we actually added a wet clean to the process step. On the right, we saw a similar thing after the post-trench etch, where we did post-trench clean by an ash, an in-situ ash in the trench etcher, followed by a plasma dry clean, and you can see on the lines these little crystalline defects that still were residue remaining on the lines. on the next slide, on number six, I want to note that I don't want you to completely discount dry cleaning or all gas phase cleaning or gas phase cleaning, because when we do studies to compare wet cleaning steps to a combination of wet and dry for some steps, particularly in this case look for via etch cleans, it turned out that split number five on that chart, which is the combined dry plus wet process, actually gave us the best results of any of the steps of trying to do all the wet cleans. Split number eight, the reference, is just the defects after a simple ashing of that process step. Slide number seven. Also, other authors have predicted the convergence of wet cleaning, meaning that we might be able to come up with some chemistry approach that has broad applications. So one clean would be able to do lots of different things. And basically this hasn't happened because single cleaning chemistries don't deal well with particles or those process excursions like I just talked about earlier that created the problems with implementation of dryer gas-based cleaning solely. They also don't work well for the large variety of new materials being introduced. Slide number 8. So in terms of looking at the new challenges of wafer cleaning, I want to talk about new materials and what's going on there. In the 1980s, it took us about 7 years to implement one new material. We worked on CVD tungsten implementation for contact plugs. But here we are in the early 2000s, and there's much more of a proliferation of new materials. New materials happening all the time. When it started with, we put in copper barriers, things like phenyl nitride, copper seed layers by PVD, copper plating became useful, and we implemented copper CMP. There's a footnote there in the middle meeting that with that implementation of copper metallization, we really, after all the years of aluminum learning, we had a lot of learning to do on copper. So defect reduction and corrosion avoidance in the copper interconnect has been one of our big challenges over the last several years. It's actually delayed some of the implementations of the 130 nanometer node devices in production. I think many companies are beginning to get a handle on this after a number of years working on it, but certainly has been implemented now. Kind of some of the new material changes then, after implementing copper, people have actually put lower K dielectrics like FSG, fluorosilicate glass. We've been all working on lower K materials in the order of 2.7 to 2.8 dielectric constant OSG materials that can be CVD deposited, and porous OSGs and porous spin-on dielectrics where we dealt with fluorine and carbon, and now I think one of the most critical issues we have to deal with in low-K dielectrics is porosity, where both the cleaning and the drying of the material is critical. Slide 9. When we first introduced copper with just the silicon dioxide dielectric, single-step cleaning showed some promise, but we had problems with particle issues, and ultimately we've had to move to multi-step cleans, particularly as we've moved to FSG and OSG. And so right now we're using multi-step wet post-CMP cleans to get the defect densities down to the levels that support high yields. In the future, as we move to ultra-low Ks and porous dielectrics, I think there'll be even more emphasis on multi-step cleans. On slide 10, likewise, when we were just using aluminum metallization, we were able to use post-etch solvent cleans. They worked well to swell the polymer residues and then remove them. But we found for copper and low-K etch residues that we're starting to have to require mixtures of materials that might be aqueous solvent mixtures, for example, adding chelating agents, buffering agents, anti-corrosion things, plus maybe water and solvents. Some of the key challenges there are to remove the residues but not change the dielectric constant or change the critical dimension. So because basically both the critical dimension of the trench or via the or you're using that determines the device performance, and the dielectric constant also has an impact on the interconnect resistance and capacity. Slide number 11, talking about other new materials, certainly most of the companies are now nitride their silicon dioxide gate dielectric to block boron penetration so that we can continue to scale dielectric, gate dielectric. Everyone's looking at high-K gate materials. TI and TI's case, the most promising material is a nitride and hafnium silicate that we've published on. We're looking at putting polycrystalline silicon germanium as a gate electrode to reduce gate depletion. We're looking at new materials for metal gate electrodes to totally avoid that depletion effect. We're moving from cobalt silicide toward nickel silicide, lower temperature processing and other things. We're looking at methods of producing a much more shallow junction and ultra-abrupt junction, things like raised source drain with both silicon and silicon germanium. And on slide 12, in terms of some of our understanding of materials and cleaning and x-rays and things, I put a chart that shows the varying etch rates of nitride and gate SiO2 dielectrics. And basically all of these processes were essentially done the same. They were attempts to deposit or grow a 25-angstrom plasma nitrided gate material followed by a 600-degree rapid thermal oxidation to help stabilize the oxide. And as a function of time and actually more of a function of the integration sequences that we've pursued in terms of actually producing these films by time. And these attempts to still grow the films the same, what's plotted here is the amount of time that we etch these films and the amount of the material etched away as a measure of etch rate. And basically, just the integration sequences of those materials, when you're talking about sub-25-angstrom films, we get some variations in those materials just based on the sequence of how we put things together. So I think there's a number of challenges in that regard. On slide 13, I just wanted to make a statement about lower thermal budgets. We've been pursuing lower thermal budgets to enable ultra-shallow and ultra-abrupt junctions, but that in itself also has introduced increased cleaning challenges because lower thermal budgets tend to lead to incomplete chemical conversion of layers, and so chemical compositions are less homogeneous, and so we've seen some examples recently with nickel silicide where the lower processing temperature requires a slightly different approach to its cleaning compared to what we used to be doing for titanium silicide or cobalt silicide more recently. On slide 14, continuing to discuss new materials, people have been looking at tantalum oxide and other things for implementation of decoupling capacitors. TI and other companies have looked at PCT as a ferroelectric material for embedded ferroelectric ramp. We've used that with iridium and iridium oxide electrodes and aluminum oxide tie balls. Other companies are pursuing other embedded memory approaches like magnetic RAM, MRAM, and O-bonding memories. You've heard a lot about silicon on insulator with partially depleted, fully depleted approaches. Strength silicon has been in the news lately, both process approaches to induce strain and stress-induced strain in the device, and also silicon germanium structures with a silicon strain layer on top that can enhance mobility of devices, and double gate or multi gate structures like FinFET and other things are in the news. So, all of those new structural approaches and new material approaches are going to mean that the amount of knowledge that we're going to have in the future about wafer cleaning surface preparation is only going to grow, and there's going to be a lot of importance in that field in the future. On slide 15, I want to spend the next a group of slides talking about what I view as being the process and equipment trends for the future in wafer cleaning. I mentioned earlier some things about single wafer cleans, and I really do believe that single wafer wet cleans are finally making some inroads. I'll talk about that in more detail in the next slides. I think implementation of clustered cleans is finally here in importance. I spent a lot of time already in talking about some of the dielectric etch or damascene etch cleans, and I think interconnect post-dielectric cleans that can deal with very high aspect ratios and the porous locate materials is going to be a key area of the future. I'm going to say a few things about advances that are needed in post-copper CMP cleans because we are still having problems in that area. And I wanted to talk a little bit about the advances in new materials cross-contamination control because I think in terms of doing cost-effective manufacturing, there are some things that are very important right now today. So in slide 16, let me talk about single wafer wet cleans. Technically, we could use single wafer wet cleans for about 85% of the cleans today, because they would work technically. But the problem is not all of them are cost-effective. In many cases, bulk cleans are still the most cost-effective approach. So really, in looking at single wafer wet clean implementations, we've been focusing on enabling applications. We've been looking at things like backside cleans for particles and metals removals that address cross-contamination issues. In copper, one of the things that we particularly noted in that regard, we had to develop wafer bevel cleans that remove copper from the wafer edge bevel, which would help to eliminate copper peeling on the wafer edges. Also, single wafer wet cleans have been implemented as post-CMP cleans. We found that you couldn't wait until an entire boatload of wafers are processed through CMP to then go take that boatload of wafers step because the amount of time the residue sits on the wafer is too long. So we found that the best results were achieved by cleaning the individual wafers immediately after the CMP step. Slide 17, more single wafer cleans are becoming cost effective, and one thing that's helping is many of the process steps are requiring better wafer-to-wafer interface control, particularly on things like pre-gated clean for the ultra-thin gate dielectrics, typically a nitrided gate today. We're looking at needing to do single wafer cleans to most rapidly get the wafers on to the next process step to control that interface. We believe that may have some merit and be worthwhile when we're doing pre-gate cleans for the high-k gate dielectrics where the interface control is going to be even more important. And just like with post-CMP cleans, we think as we go to porous low-k dielectrics, it may be critical to clean and dry that material right after the etch and then go cap that material with the barrier and seed layers for copper deposition to control what happens there. In the early, on slide 18 on clustered cleans, in the early 1990s, we did it, or late 80s, I guess this was the early 1990s, we did it. Joint Semitech, MSI, AT&T, and TI gate clustering project. We clustered an Excalibur II vapor HF cleaning system to a single wafer rapid thermal oxidation and rapid thermal CVD polysilicon deposition. And we found at that point where we were using gate dielectrics down to about 28 angstroms, we saw little or no improvement in the gate property. So there wasn't any real improvements in the gate by having clustered process steps. In slide 19, however, here we are in 2002, we've been reevaluating that, and today we're actually clustering the oxidation, plasma nitridation, and the polysilicon gate electrode deposition together for 15 angstrom gate dielectrics. We don't currently have the capability of cluster and clean to it today just because of equipment issues, but we believe we're seeing about a 1 to 2 angstrom improvement in the gate effective oxide thickness, and by that clustering, that's going to help us to delay maybe on the order of a year when we have to have a high kick replacement gate ready. So I think clustering is to a point, particularly down at 15 inch from gate dielectric, that we do see benefits of clustering. And that'll be a subject of a future paper that TI gives with some more details about all of that. And slide 20, for post-EMP claims, as I mentioned earlier, clustering to avoid time lag is important. For advanced post-damascene etch cleaning, we also are seeing merit to moving to a dry platinum step to condition the photoresist with little or no overash because you don't want to impact this critical dimension. Follow that with by a wet process to remove the residue so that there's little or no lag time for air exposure. And I think there's some improvements there. Slide 21, as I already mentioned, we think we'll use cluster cleans prior to high tech gate and also cluster the gate electrode deposition to continue to control those interfaces. On slide 22, I'm going to spend the next several slides on post-damascene etch cleans. As I mentioned earlier, the key aspects are we're going to have to deal with very high aspect ratio vias and porous locate dielectrics, but yet we can't change the critical dimension and we can't have an impact on the dielectric constant. One of the technologies that we think is having a great promise in that regard today is supercritical CO2 processing. A number of people have attempted to use supercritical CO2 to replace the entire ash and clean steps. This hasn't worked well for us because of the loading effects of etching the entire bulk photoresist and the bark layer, and that tends to load up the system. And after a while, after you've run hundreds of wafers, that loading effect tends to create more defects. So in slide 23, basically, we found much better results to do something like a soft ash with a small bias to control the reaction of the locate and not etch the locate material to remove the bulk of the photoresist residue, and then follow it with a supercritical CO2 clean with some sort of co-solvent to remove the residue. As I mentioned before, the careabouts are not to change the K value of the locate dielectric, and I'll show you some data in a minute that shows that action can actually change what's happening in the porous locate material with some of the surface bonding and thing, and actually can change the K value. The processing of the ashing and the cleaning can actually etch the locate material and change the critical dimension. And likewise, we found that drying of the porous locate material is required to control the K value of the material. And the enabling features of supercritical CO2 is the near zero viscosity, which helps to displace the water, and the near zero surface tension that allows you to remove all the residue later. So in slide 24, I've made some speculation that even if supercritical CO2 doesn't finally work for the residue removal, but we think it is working, it could find an application just for the porous locate drying. And I'll show you some data about that in a few minutes. Several researchers are also looking at supercritical CO2 for other things, of trace contaminant removal. There's an SRC program funded today looking at supercritical CO2 as a photoresist developer to replace solvents or reduce the adhesive solvents. One of the key issues is, will supercritical CO2 be cost effective? We believe it will because it uses small amounts of co-solvents, so it can dramatically reduce the cost of the solvent usage, and solvents are very expensive both in terms of cost of purchase and cost of of capture and disposal. We've also looked at supergiggle CO2 from a CO2 usage standpoint, and certainly capture and recycle the CO2 can make it even more cost effective. In slide 25, I want to talk a little about supergiggle CO2 and some of the process results to date. Here's an evaluation on the top. The K value of the low K dielectric, in this case a porous methyl sulfesquioxane ultra low K material. In this case, it's a spin on dielectric. The as deposited K value of the material is about 2.25. After you just do an ash, the K value actually goes up to about 2.55. If you just do a wet clean following that ash with a heated dry, it further increases to about 2.67. And if we take the ash material and do a supergiggle CO2 clean, we can get back down to about 2.37, so much closer to the as deposited material. We've started looking into why that happens, and the chart on the bottom shows that we've looked at some thermal desorption spectroscopy and analyzing what comes off the surface as a function of temperature. And what we see is if you just take the ash sample and do that, there's a large peak that peaks at about 350 degrees due to silanol removal from the surface, SIOH. And so the ash obviously changes the surface and highly creates a lot of silanol bonds. And the post-wet etch and heated dry clean, it looks very similar. But if you do supergiggle CO2, you change the surface quite a lot, and you move the peak back to 200, which is more of just fizz-absorbed water, which has a lower impact on the K value and is repairable because we think you can drive it off and remove it with a supergiggle CO2. Going on to the next slide, 26, we further looked at that with FTIR to look at some of the bonding there of those films. And what we saw is in the post-ash or pre-supergiggle CO2 on top, we saw a peak due to the silanol SIOH bond. And post-SCCO2, we see that dramatically decrease. So we think there is some evidence that this is due to silanol. In slide 27, there's a lot of development still to be done on supergiggle CO2. Where in the middle you can see a post-ash and pre-supergiggle CO2 surface, where right on the center of each one of the lines you can see the residue left there. We found some ways to get it clean if you go to the right, where you can get a clean surface, but we've also found lots of ways to not work well. If you look downward, we can actually create processes in supergiggle CO2 that actually lift the dielectric leads. On the left of the bottom, we can actually have conditions that where some of the residue is removed, but then there's huge redepositions that actually create problems between the leads. And then there's some mechanisms to the left side where it simply doesn't clean well. And all the approaches to doing those cleans, there's a lot of chemistry involved of what co-solvent you pick and what approaches you do to those cleaning. And that was the subject of a number of other talks at this conference I was at. And Anthony Muscat can give you some follow-up on that. He was at that conference if you're interested in following that. In slide 28, there's some cautions about supergiggle CO2 cleaning that I'm worried about. In the past, in processing systems, we've learned that anytime you have significant pressure changes, gas flow changes, and temperature changes, you can generate particles due to physical and chemical processes going on in the gas phase. And therefore, I think there will be some great challenges in producing very clean wafers and supercritical CO2 systems. So the system design and when you have wafers and the sequencing of the wafers versus when you have pressure changes, gas flow changes, and temperature changes in the system, I think are going to be very critical to whether or not we achieve defect-free process steps in supercritical CO2. 29, post-CMP cleaning. Single-step cleans are not working well, as I mentioned before. Copper CMP residues are very difficult to remove. There's diode-induced corrosion effects. Copper scratches, copper CMP damage to the low-K materials. And those differences in materials between the corrosion product, between copper that's scratched up, and between the low-K material that's gouged up, since they have different compositions, we haven't found single-step approaches that have worked well. So we've combined things like dilute acids or solvents and scrubbers, or in spray tools or in immersion tanks, and those follow-up cleans are pretty critical to low defect density. In slide 30, I just simply say that we still need better copper CMP clean processes. So some of the work that's happening in the center about understanding copper CMP and copper CMP cleans is extremely important. Likewise, CMP has been a real enabler for our industry, but there's still a lot of deficiencies with CMP. Some of the issues with copper CMP are things called dishing and erosion, where the control of that across the wafers is extremely important. And really, this industry could use a new CMP new copper planarization process desperately that overcomes some of those problems, or some really tremendous improvement in copper CMP would be enough. Slide 31, I want to talk about the new materials cross-contamination control and why is that important. It's important because one approach you can take to just managing cross-contamination control of new materials is just buy and dedicate equipment just for those new materials. But if you just simply buy all new equipment and totally dedicate them only to that material processing, it's not a very cost-effective use of those process tools. And we found that a better approach is to understand where you really need to dedicate the tool and understand cross-contamination of the protocol. And slide 32, had a couple of people whose names are listed there who worked at TI to develop our copper cross-contamination protocol. Basically, they used a number of techniques that were well known to wafer cleaning people, total reflection x-ray fluorescence, and vapor phase decomposition, inductively coupled plasma mass spec were used for metal detections on wafer surfaces. We ran them through systems during process conditions and looked at the resulting cross-contamination control. And then later on, we actually added time-of-flight sims when we were trying to evaluate the local signatures on the wafers where we couldn't find a small amount of the contaminant localized with other techniques. We could look at the edge of wafers and things with time-of-flight sims. In slide 33, basically what resulted were when we found contamination, for example, on the backside of wafers, we developed single wafer backside cleans so that we could do a clean and then actually take that copper wafer onto some other step and not have to dedicate tools. So in our fabs today at TI, we're actually sharing the lithography and metrology tools for front-end-of-line and copper metallization wafers. So we're not dedicating lithography tools, for example, or metrology tools because they're very expensive and we don't want to do that. So another aspect of it is we had to develop protocols that just in a steady state condition of just wafers running through the chambers everything worked fine, but we found that occasionally if you actually broke a copper wafer in a tool that was a shared tool, we had to develop new protocols for ways, effective ways to go in and clean up that tool and make sure we removed any copper contamination before we proceeded with processing other wafers. We've used that same approach to a bunch of other new materials that we've been experimenting with, nickel sulfide, tungsten oxide, zirconium and hafnium silicate, high-gate dielectric materials, lead zirconium titanate for ferroelectric RAM materials, iridium and iridium oxide electrodes for that same ferroelectric RAM. And basically, developing the cross-contamination protocols and understanding what's happened has saved us a lot of time and money, and it actually can be cost prohibitive to look at that number of different materials if you had to buy dedicated tools for each one of them. In slide 34, I just give one example where time of flight since gave us more data than the TEFRF or VPD, ICP-MS, where we actually didn't see any differences with TEFRF and VPD approaches, but when we looked at time of flight sims, we could actually localize nickel contamination to the edge of wafers and understand what was really going on in a clampless deposition system and better understand what was going on in our processing system. In slide 35, we actually have continued that with high-gate cross-contamination control, and we've looked at the amount of hafnium or zirconium on a surface coming into a tool, and then we've run the wafers coming out of that tool through SCC backside cleaners and looked at the amount of contamination remaining on the backside. In most cases, it's reduced by one or two orders of magnitude and brought down to levels of 1 e to the 9 pounds per square centimeter that's tolerable for our process steps. In slide 36, I just pulled this slide from a number of years ago when we were trying to understand what are the different properties of materials that you have to worry about in cross-contamination control. And this might just be an example of something you would go pull up and look at. We compared vapor pressures of zirconium and hafnium and things like that, and we started to see trends, and we've actually borne out that zirconium creates a little bit more of a problem from a cross-contamination standpoint than hafnium, and it's consistent with some of the vapor pressure numbers and other properties of the materials. Slide 37. We found that one of the definite areas from an equipment standpoint that you have to worry about cross-contamination the most is in the etchers, because as you would imagine, that as you're etching films and actually the plasma is creating movement of atoms of the various materials throughout the chamber, depositing on the sidewalls of the chambers and other things. So generally, we found that etchers are a place where you have to worry the most about cross-contamination. So we tend to most of all dedicate them to the etches. And in this example of the data here, we actually see that pre-etch and post-etch, there tends to be an increase in the amount of that element present in the chamber. It changes from wafer to wafer, but basically in the etcher there tends to be a buildup of a background level of, in this case, zirconium, for a zirconium silicate etch. And for hafnium silicate, in slide 38, there tends to be not as big an issue. There is somewhat of a buildup, but it tends to be generally lower than the 1 e to the 9th level that we require to not have any worries about impact on the devices. In slide 39, I wanted to tie some of the wafer cleaning to the ESH focus, and certainly the move to dilute chemistries in the past number of years has helped us so that wafer cleaning would be more positive from an ESH standpoint. the dilute chemistries were safer for workers. We used less chemicals. There was less chemical disposal required. And likewise, I think the use of supercritical CO2 with small amounts of co-solvents will have some ESH improvement. I think it will reduce the total solvent use, therefore reducing chemical use, waste, and disposal will be safer for workers. It could be that the drying of supercritical CO2 would reduce our IPA use for drying. And there's been some worry discussed that supercritical CO2 would increase ozone depletion by more CO2 emissions. But as we looked at it more, our industry won't generate any new CO2 in this whole process, but simply we'll use CO2 that's been produced as other industry byproducts. We would, that it'd be normally exhausted to the atmosphere anyway. We'll use it in our industry, and at most it'll be just re-exhausted to the atmosphere. And in slide 41, I talk about CO2 calibration, and we've been doing some thinking about what kind of levels make a difference. And in the second bullet there, we looked and found out that each day a human releases about 2.2 pounds of CO2. So for the 5 million people in the DFW Metroplex, there's about 458,000 pounds per hour emitted of CO2. There's another example for gasoline consumption. And we've done some calculations that for a 40,000 wafer start per month, wafer fab using a 10-level metal device where you might use supercritical CO2 for the post-ash coins and the damascene process steps, we would utilize about 5,000 pounds per hour of the CO2, hopefully recycled from production of other sources. So in slide 42, I'll summarize by saying that I think we need to be diligent in the early ESH assessments of new chemicals before we get them implemented into routine use, and do that during the development stages while there's still time to change which chemicals are used. And early identification of those ESH issues can help us to eliminate delays and problems later, that if we identify a problem later, we have to go switch the chemical and change later, or live with lots of problems of exposure. So I'm pleased to be a part of an industry where that industry has been reasonably proactive in environmental safety and health issues. So I'll wrap up my talk there. That was the last slide, and I'll be glad to answer any questions people have.
So thanks very much, Alan.
Okay.
Any questions for or discussion for Alan?
Yes, this is Vane Borghanti from Ashland Chemical.
Yes.
Alan, I have a quick question.
Sure.
It's a very good presentation. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you.
In the vapor clean, you know, we talked about single vapor cleaning and the back time. Is there any trend towards either a dilute chemistries versus organics-based chemical for cleaning?
I would say probably there's been more use of dilute acids from that standpoint for that particular application. And certainly we're still using solvents in the post-damascene etch cleaning. And even with the supercritical CO2 approach, it uses small amounts of co-solvents because of the polar nature of what you're trying to do there. So I would think, you know, there's some applications of both, but in terms of the specific backside cleaning and stuff, I think dilute acids have probably made more inroads there.
Thank you.
Okay.
Alan, this is Gary Ribbock.
Hi, Gary.
Hi. It seems to me that you've given a very strong pitch for heterogeneous process integration at the cluster tool level.
Yeah.
Where are the tool suppliers on this now?
For a few process steps, I think they're recognized and doing well with it. I mean, things like post-CMP claims, most CMP suppliers today sell an integrated post-CMP cleaner. And although you may have to come out of that and go into some subsequent processing for this multi-step clean to really get to the cleanliness levels you want, I think they recognize that you have to do cleaning quickly and are integrating those. In the front end of wine, I think there are some issues where even though we're beginning to see the onset of impact of clustering, the equipment suppliers are generally not yet convinced. I think part of that is due to the work we did a number of years ago where it, you know, on the order of 28 to 30 angstrom gate dielectrics, we showed there wasn't much of an impact. And at that point, some of the equipment suppliers had some pretty heavy investments of trying to do that clustering at that point. So I think they've been a little more skeptical of exactly when to go spend a large amount of money to do clustering of the front-end process steps and exactly when that's going to be required. And so I think that's why it's going to be important for some of the experimental evidence that we're starting to gain and get that out there to show them that it may be time to do that investment again. But there definitely have been some boundaries about what you can do in terms of clustering, especially the cleans.
Thank you.
Alan, this is Rob Rivito from National ACT.
Yeah.
Recently, a lot of fabs have been going toward simpler, cheaper type products like dilute acids, dilute HF, DMAH, that type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
It was my understanding that the industry got away from that 4, 5, 6 years ago because of CD loss, that the etch rates were too high. And I would think as we get, as we shrink to smaller and smaller geometries, that effect is magnified.
I agree with you totally.
Is this just a cost issue that fabs are just trying to cut costs and they're going back and reinvestigating simpler things?
Yes, I believe so. I think there's tremendous cost pressures and so I think that's a real key area they've been working on, but often some of those analyses don't look at what's coming next in the next node of product, and definitely I think there are some impacts there. So I want people to be very careful in proceeding that pathway for the future, that we're going to have to relook at that at each node because of the etch and CD loss issue that you mentioned.
Thank you.
Is it Ian Wiley from Cabot Microelectronics?
No.
I was just wondering if the CO2, I assume you're using pretty high pressure, of course.
Yeah.
You've seen any effect of CO2 incorporation into any of the film?
I don't think we've seen any problems with that. I think it's much more of
I don't want to necessarily worry about it being a problem, but it seems to me that some of it might dissolve in some of the layers and incorporate itself in there.
Yeah. Since many of the low-K dielectrics are already having a fair amount of carbon in them,
right.
I don't think it's a big issue for us. I don't think we've looked and tried to quantify it, but it doesn't seem that that's changed the film properties significantly, since particularly we already are incorporating some carbon anyway.
Well, low-K dielectrics are supposed to be porous these days, or becoming porous.
They're becoming porous.
And the CO2 does dissolve really well in anything that's slightly organic.
Right.
But admittedly, it may take many hours or maybe even days before it saturates. But,
right. And, you know, we're trying to get these process steps to be, you know, on the order of a minute per wafer so
right.
that we get enough throughput capabilities. So I think we're avoiding some of those issues.
One of the interesting things would be to see where that failure point might occur, if it does. I mean, if it takes 2 days for there to be any change, and you do it in 2 minutes, then you don't have any worry.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, just pick a thought.
Yeah. I'll pass that on to the people doing that work.
Okay. Very good talk.
Thank you.
Hi, this is Stephen for Hubbleton from My Materials.
Hi, Steve.
Hey, I had a quick question on slide number 20, where you actually said that the one proposal is to go to a spine plug, not then to condition for the return with no over ash,
right,
and then for the wet process. Now, I thought the biggest issue with cave shift is on the sidewall, not so much on the top of the...
That's probably true.
The concave.
Yeah.
So, does this address also the sidewall concave issues? Or
yeah, it does, because that note about actually having no overash, typically it's the overash step where you're still trying to get the residue off the top. If you're doing an overash, that has the biggest impact on the sidewall. So you're basically trying to stop the plasma ashing before you do damage to the sidewall and impact the CD.
Okay. What about the difference between a directional ash with a large bias or versus that they have more isotropic downstream?
Uh-huh.
Do you have any experience with that?
I don't personally, but I've heard some discussion about that, and I think you might argue in this particular case that something that has directionality and is more preferential to that photoresist that's on the top that doesn't have the impact on the stuff on the sidewall might be a good approach first.
Okay. Thanks, Bob.
Okay.
I'll bite if there's still time. This is John DeGenova.
Hi, John.
Hey, you mentioned a lot about the copper cross-contamination.
Yes.
And that just focuses on the copper itself. Do you see any other clean room issues with the processes and the chemistries used in the copper processing that can be a contamination issue?
Speculation. One of the speculations is that we've been using a lot more organic materials as corrosion inhibitors and solvents in the back end processing for the post-damaging cleans, and that's raising the level of organics in the current clean room atmosphere. And as we've gone to lower wavelengths in the DPB scanners we're using, there has tended to be more of a reaction of those organics with those wavelengths that create contamination on the lenses of our scanners. And I don't know that I can definitely tie those two together. It's more of a speculation at this point. But certainly there have been a number of companies that have been pursuing active carbon filtration of the air around the scanners to try to overcome some of the contamination problems. And I don't know if that's totally related to what we're doing, that we're raising the level of carbon in our organics in our fab by doing what we're doing, or if that's just kind of all the natural levels. But I think there may be some worry about other materials, definitely, that you should have.
And what about chemicals with the high-K material?
I guess I haven't heard anything in that regard, but certainly we're looking at the possibility of spin on ultra-low-K dielectrics with porosity, so that the approaches there might have an impact, but I'm not real familiar with any specific issues yet.
Thanks.
Okay.
Well, Alan, on behalf of the center, I'd like to thank you very much for a nice overview where you reached down into a lot of the technical details as well.
Okay.
So next week we'll hear from Charles Musgrave at Stanford University. So thanks very much, everyone.
Thank you.